You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, guys. Welcome to Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader, and Bob Morano's here from Every Day is Feast Day. Unbelievable. I'm so glad he's here. But before we get to it, let's just take care of a little business. And first things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This grinder is awesome for you. For if you're removing material, you're a knife maker, you're removing material, this is for you. And if you go to BroadbeckIronworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off everything, all their grinders, attachments, parts. Great American company doing great things, manufacturing, small business, this is for you. I'm with you. Next are my friends at Even Heat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. Get that tap control. Get that solid state drive. If you're trying to make knives, hammers, you're trying to harden things. If you're a ceramicist, if you're a glassblower, you need to use a kiln. These are the kilns for you. Go check out evenheat-kiln.com and see what the fuss is about. But we can't get much better than Even Heat. I'm telling you, I've been involved with these guys for a long time, and Even Heat's I can't make knives without my Even Heat, so don't play. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply, maritimeknifesupply.com, for all your knife-making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, press, heat treating ovens, anvils, and much, much more. They're in Canada. They ship to the United States with ease, and you can take advantage of that exchange rate, and we'll see in the next couple weeks what that's going to be, but we're going to figure it out. I'm with Lawrence Lake, and let me tell you something. If you're in Canada or United States, this is one of the best suppliers of all time. He is a knife maker, too, so he knows what you need. And if you're in Canada and you're thinking to yourself, I really wish Lawrence had this, tell him, and he'll get it for you. So definitely go check out MaritimeKnifeSupply.com, and I will give you, if you're a knife maker, go get yourself some of them Norton Razor Star yellow belts. The 36 grit belts are my favorite belt. I've been saying this for a little bit, and I swear those Norton belts are my favorites, but the Razor Stars, forget about it. So go check them out, and when you get a 10-pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off. So see what all the fuss is about at Maritime Knife Supply. Many thanks to my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise. Their vices are built in the heart of Texas, and they're designed to take your handle finishing to a whole new level. Whether you're hand sanding, they got a platform that allows you to protect your knife and take care of that distal taper, and you can hand sand with ease. Or if you want to put it in the, turn it around after you finish that handle and you want to finish that handle up in style, you can use it there. If you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, you can put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off everything, including their T4 Sentinel Oil, handle press attachment, everything like that. So definitely go check out what's going on over at Trojan Horse Forge and get that Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise. Things are awesome, and they go quick, so get on to it. Next are my friends at Baker Forge. BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram for all that exotic steels, the Tiger Mai, Bronze Mai, Copper Mai, all that clad stuff with the beautiful carbon steel core in the middle, easy to work with, super duper easy to heat treat, super duper easy to grind and finish. And when you finish it, you got to use their proprietary etching. It's called Gator Piss. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, Gator Piss. This stuff is awesome. No one talks about etchants like when they talk about it, Gator Piss. And I tell you what, it's the best in the market. Usually etchants are if you're trying to reveal the pattern of your Damascus or your different types of sand mines or something like that, you're going to need some etching. And usually what you do is you get ferric chloride and water. Well, you don't know There's a certain ratio, and you don't have to do it yourself anymore. Get yourself some of that gator piss. Go to BakerForge.com, and you put in the promo code Full Blast, and you're going to get 10% off everything there. And if you want, you can also go to our friends at Texas Farrier Supply. Texas Farrier Supply is an awesome knife-making company in Texas. Knife supply, blacksmith supply, bladesmith supply, farrier supply. If you need to get started or resupplied, you go to Texas Farrier Supply. You can get the gator piss, too. And if you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off everything. Love my guys over at Texas Farrier Supply, and Baker Forge stuff is the best. And by the way, the Baker Forge guys are working hard on that stainless clad, the stainless core copper mize and all that stuff. So they're going to be working with stainless Damascus and all that stuff. And that, in my opinion, is and we talk about this on Knife Talk, that's the future of knife making, is stainless steel, pattern welded steel. So go check out Baker Forge and Texas Farrier Supply. Next thing is my friends at Total Boat, makers of adhesive paints, primers, polishing compounds. It used to be for just boaters and DIYers. Now everybody's using it because the stuff is awesome. Now, I use their two-part epoxy, the Total Boat two-part epoxy, for all my handle scales. For my construction, I use their CA glues. Their CA glues are really good. Their UV cure resin, I really like that very much. And if you're trying to get involved with hybrid handle materials, their Fathom Thick Set is dynamite. So definitely check out what's going on. If you go to totalboat.com/fullblast, you can get an affiliate code that gets you some discount and, more importantly, gets me street cred. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. And, oh, by the way, you don't have to, you can put your pen down. You can put your paper down. You don't have to write anything, because in the show notes where you're listening to this is all the hyperlinks, all the deals, whatever you need. So go check out what's going on over at totalboat.com/fullblast. If it's good enough for Keith Decent, Derek from Malden, Keith Johnson, Keith Mitchell, and even that scoundrel Jimmy DiResta, it's good enough for you, okay? Boy, oh boy, just got off the phone with my guy, G.L. Hansen & Sons. That's G.L. Hansen & Sons. He's the guy who makes that amazing G-Carta. And you're saying to me, what is G-Carta again? G-Carta is a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed under epoxy with pressure and heat. It's the stuff that kind of looks like brain coral for handle scales, or there's stuff that looks like a pheasant. There's a pheasant style, and there's hoop. They have different names, a Hoopla, a Colorama. They have amazing stuff. It's really great. It's basically, imagine micarta, and then they cross-cut it, but then they make it in like all these different colors and patterns and stuff. Is awesome. And if you're getting involved in trying to make something a little bit different for yourself, go get yourself some of that G-Carta, and you go to gcarta.bigcartel.com and see what the fuss is about. I'm getting a block of the Hoopla from my mans, from my guy. Where am I getting Colorama? Hoopla or Colorama? The stuff is awesome, and he sends me the stuff, and I love working with it, so definitely check out gcarta.bigcartel.com. I want to thank my friends at Tormek, celebrating 50 years of being in business with the Black TH sharpening system. This is the best. I love the Tormek for sharpening my knives, but at the same time, it started as something for woodworkers to sharpen their chisels. It's the best. And you go to Tormek_sharpening on Instagram, you can see what they're doing. You go to Tormek.com, you can get yourself squared away, you can figure out where to go. They're global. You can get a Tormek anywhere in the world, no matter where you're listening to this, you can get a Tormek. And if you have any questions, you can definitely send a message into Tormek_sharpening on Instagram, or you can send it to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. I'd be happy to answer all your questions. I love Tormek. I'm with them. And I had a great time when I was with them in Sweden, and we're going to deal with them again soon. Many thanks to my boys over at Tormek. And last but certainly not least, I want to welcome back aboard my good friends at Nordic Edge. That's Nordic_Edge on Instagram. Go to NordicEdge.com.au. Nordic Edge is about the joy of making something with your own hands. This is the one-stop shop for tools, supplies that will help you become a knife-making, blacksmithing, leatherworking, spoon carving, and other crafts where you get to take some time for yourself and turn ideas into something tangible. Nordic Edge also holds workshops for blacksmithing, knife-making, spoon carving. They have a great website with all their stuff. And if you're in Australia, this is the place for you. Bjorn and the guys are awesome. Not only do they sell all the stuff for knife making, blacksmithing, and bladesmithing, and all that stuff, leatherwork and all that, but they also teach classes. So if you go to nordicedge.com.au, you can see what's going on with them. And listen, they have the guidance to help accelerate your creativity, and they got the tools, products, and supplies to help you manifest your ideas. Ain't get much better than that. nordicedge.com.au. And without any further ado, I want to welcome aboard Bob Morano. Bob is my guy. Every day is feast day. Bob is this guy I've known for a while. He's a Hudson Valley chef, and he does these amazing reels on Instagram, and he's teaching people how to cook, and he's just such a positive personality on the internet, and I'm really glad to know you. Bob, how the hell are you?
I'm good. Thank you for the introduction. That was a good one. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm okay. I'm okay. You know, it's Hudson Valley weather I could do without, but you know how it is.
Yeah, I do. We were just talking. We haven't gotten one, you know, real snowstorm yet this season. So we might have one left in us before it departs.
You know what? I was about to be so happy that you're here, but just saying that is enough to like get me down. I can't take any more snow, Bob.
All right, I'll try.
I've been in the Hudson Valley for. I've grown up in. My father had a winery in Clinton Corners, not too far from you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent, you know, most of my life in the Hudson Valley area. So I know all about this Hudson Valley winter. And we just had some snow last night. It wasn't too much, but I'm getting old, my guy. I don't know how much more I can take.
Yeah, and it is. It's always that downside of dragging the snowblower out and timing all the stuff and everything. But I could definitely do without it. But there's still a part of me that like gets the little butterflies when we're getting a storm that comes in and we're going to get nailed.
Well, you know what the thing is just knowing. You know, getting the idea, we've talked on the phone before, mm-hmm. and getting to know your kind of personality from your Instagram, every day is feast day, feels like you're a very positive character.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
So how did you get involved with, well, let's just start from the beginning. So you and I met, you know, maybe a couple years ago, just started following each other on Instagram. And what was amazing to me was you're very, very good at in cooking Instagram videos. Your reels are very succinct. They're very smart. They're very simple. They're very approachable. And you're very consistent with what you do. How did you get involved with doing Instagram video cooking? Or should I say social media cooking?
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, thanks for the compliments there. I was kind of looking for a way to artistically express what I like the videos that I made, and I had I guess we go back pre-pandemic. I was teaching a class, a food program, at one of the local school districts. They had a program called Chef in the Classroom, where they would have a professional chef come in once a month and teach different grades. About food, and we would do lectures and recipes, and you do like kindergarten all the way through eighth grade.
Wow.
So I did that for like about 2.5 school years, full school years. And I just really gravitated towards the educational aspect of it. And I started to build that program as I was doing it, as if it was my own business. Hmm. So I started to build all the lesson plans and recipes. And I have, I have a few friends that are teachers in the area. So I would get with them to make sure that I'm hitting all of the, the necessary requirements, educational requirements for the kids. And then I had, my plan was to try to take this program and then go and maybe sell it to other districts. Cause you know, I think the school that I was at uses different types of grants. Hmm. But you know, there's different grants that are available. So, you know, I try to put two and two together. If I can develop this program and then find grants to pay for it, it's almost like a no brainer for schools, especially once parents find out about it, that there might be like a culinary education for their kids. And like I said, we were doing as young as kindergarten, and to see the kids like gravitate to cracking eggs and working with different types of textural stuff is just, I mean, it's incredible just to see. And then when the pandemic came, they shut the program down. They closed the schools, and then when they reopened schools, they weren't allowing outside people to come back in the schools. We're years away from that. I don't know if they started the program again. But it sort of really ignited both my desire and just my kind of love of educating and teaching. And also you start to realize that I think we're really losing like a generation of home cooks. I'm 43, so like my parents, you know, my mother cooked and my grandmother was always in the kitchen everywhere. And I think we're kind of losing that as we move into the generation of like ordering everything and making less of our own food at home, which obviously leads to eating more prepared things and processed foods and things like that. And it just, you know, it leads to poorer food decisions. And so I kind of just thought to start making some videos and just putting them online, and it kind of grows into that thing where, I mean, when you start to do something consistently, you get better at it, you know, right, as you go. You know, the more you can do it, you start doing things daily, you get better at these things, whether it's making culinary videos or knives or whatever, you know, whatever the subject is. But it really kind of pulled me in, and I think the response to the education piece of it is, I think, what keeps me like creatively going at it.
It's the whole thing's interesting because, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here. One of the things is I went to culinary school back in, I guess, 1999, something like that, 1999, 2000. And I went to now it's the Institute of Culinary Education, but it was Peter Kump on 23rd Street in Manhattan. And one of the things that I found interesting about culinary school was that my teacher would say that there's only really, he said it's very controversial, but the only real indigenous food in the United States is Cajun food. And we started talking about how food has changed in anthropology of American food. And the thing is he said, you know, if you go to France, you see these families who have been passing on recipes for generations upon generations, passing it along. But in the United States, because of the way food has changed with the advent of supermarkets and prepared foods and, you know, more people working and less people at home and, divorce rates and all this stuff, you're finding that what you said is connected was that the idea that the home cooking isn't as pushed as it used to be or in other cultures.
Yeah. And I think it's such an interesting point to bring up. Even just the generational aspect of it, of having like your kids in the kitchen. You know, I remember a time when I was in the kitchen with my grandmother and we'd spend a lot of time, and just those types of memories and bonds that you form, you know, while you teach your kids a useful skill, you know, it's like, as we go, you know, you can teach your kids to cook more of their own food and really change like almost how the globe looks, both literally and, you know, figuratively. If your kids are able to make a simple meal of food or kind of know what goes into some foods rather than you just grabbing things out of the cabinets or grabbing, you know, opening packages or whatever. And then all of the things that you touched on as far as like the relationship aspect of it, the marital status aspect of it, like all of these other things that come with the effort that you put in to just do, you know, having those experiences.
When you started doing Every Day's Feast Day, what do you think? What was your, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about what you do is you kind of have, I would say, I would break down how you do your reels into two different reels. You do the actual cooking videos, which are amazing because, number one, they're very approachable. It's simple cooking. It's proper technique. It's nothing crazy. You're not doing anything that's a little bit like, you know, over someone's head, or it's not talking down to people. It's not pretending like you're better than someone else. It's very approachable and very good food. But then you also have these other reels where you're doing this almost, you're outside and you're kind of having the word of the day or an expression, or you're kind of like doing these teaching moments instead of cooking, just, you know, showing. When did you decide to figure out how you were going to do all your reels? And then, because I feel as though you're very disciplined in how you set these up. They're very organized. They're awesome. They're terrific. I get so many messages from people who are like, this guy's terrific. I've learned so much. And I see the comments you get on Facebook and on Instagram. When did you figure out this is what I'm going to do and I'm not going to deviate from the how I'm going to launch these reels?
I don't know. Thank you. That means a lot because that's what you're talking about is kind of what I aim to do at that sort of group. But yeah, I think it's, I don't know specifically where it came from. It almost came in an effort to just create something different, like a different type of content other than the cooking and the recipe videos.
Yeah.
While still kind of giving people like, you know, they still flow with the educational piece. And to some of the words of the day will be like industry terms that your general public isn't familiar with. And I think with, especially with the popularization of shows like The Bear and some of these other, you know, food industry shows or food industry movies, that the I think it generates a lot of interest from the general public as to what goes on behind the scenes, like these secrets behind the door, you know, behind the kitchen doors and what goes on in kitchens. And I think people just have a real interest in you know, because most people are not living in kitchens, in professional kitchens at least. And it just kind of like they started to get a following. I think people like a lot of them will include historical facts or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I think people just have that natural, you know, a lot of people have that natural hunger to learn a little bit. And I think it also makes it a lot of fun for me because I get to research a lot of these, especially the words of the day. Some of them I, you know, kind of are able to just go on, but I would say most of them I have to do some research and kind of put together that piece of content. So I have this whole education on those things that I have given myself. So I think that's it. That also keeps me coming back to those pieces.
And your delivery is always very succinct. Your delivery is always very good. There's no ums and ahs, and you're always very clear, and everything you do is always great. What's interesting to me is because I've been dealing with knife. Well, not knife. I've been dealing with chefs for a long time, and I've been doing a lot of collaborations. And when I see, I love cooking reels because, you know, I find it, you know, I'm like my wife and my daughter and I, we all communicate through Instagram anyway. So if we see something that we want, my wife wants me to make, she'll send me a reel. You know, that's how we almost communicate. It's funny because the three of us all communicate by sending each other reels and, you know, what we like, what we don't like. And what's interesting about what you do is different than a lot of people is you're in the reels. Every time the camera is on the food, you're in there too, and you're talking to the camera, and it gives a more of an educational, maybe it's unconscious, but you're definitely giving more of an educational expertise as opposed to, you know, like, I don't want to be in the videos. I don't want to, if I didn't have to be in the videos, I wouldn't be in the videos. And you know, I, regardless, we'll talk about that another time. But the thing is like, a lot of videos I do see by cooking people, they're not in the videos either. There'll be the camera will be on the food and you'll see, and then there'll be some voiceover. But every time there's the camera is on you or the food, you're in there. Do you think that was a practical decision or it just happened to be?
You know, I don't think, I definitely didn't make the decision, like, should I be in it or should I not be in it? I think it just kind of naturally came organically in the beginning. But it's, for me, I don't mind being in it. I think even hearing you say it, I think it adds to the, like you said, it adds to sort of the educational thing. And in some ways I kind of like picture someone, you know, they catch the video somewhere on TikTok or Instagram or something. And they might go, oh, I'm going to make that this weekend. Let me save this video somewhere. And then I, you know, in my head, I picture them almost like you can prop it up in your kitchen and we're kind of cooking along together.
Yeah.
Almost in those, you know, we don't have the Alton Browns anymore in the capacity that he was at, you know, say, I don't know, 10, 15, 20, whatever years ago he was on. Or even the Julia Childs and even the Jacques Pepins are kind of relegated to PBS and they're not kind of in that mainstream part where you're learning from people who, you know, have decades under their belt of what they're doing and what they're talking about. And I think people, the desire is there for that.
Glad you brought Jacques Pepin up. I was gonna bring Jacques Pepin up anyway. You know, obviously Jacques Pepin, one of the greatest of all time. I would say that if I had people keeping me I've said this in the spot.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I guess a million times I was a latchkey kid. My parents were divorced, grew up in the 70s and 80s in New York. You know, and I had the radio, and then sometimes I had the PBS on. I was watching Jacques Pepin and Julia Childs, and that was really always, because he's cooking. My father was a cook, and he was never really around. But the thing about Jacques Pepin is he's cooking, and he's talking in a nice way. He's talking nicely to you. And there was always something about him. And then right before the pandemic, he and I, his daughter and his son-in-law, who run his account, reached out to me because we're friends in common. Charlie Palmer is my old boss, is Charlie Palmer.
Okay.
And we ended up chatting, and I ended up sending a couple knives to Jacques Pepin, and he ended up using them in all his videos during the pandemic, pre-pandemic to the pandemic, were probably the most popular things he's ever done, more than all the years he did TV.
Exactly,
reading
yeah.
all these articles. His videos are amazing. His reels are awesome. And one of the things about it is it was all very approachable food. He wasn't trying to impress anybody. He wasn't trying to be condescending. He was trying to really kind of help people make food in their homes. And it was just very approachable stuff. And when he started using my knives, it was just like over the moon. I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah. Yep.
You're the only other collaborator I've worked with where the ethos of Fader Knives. We've been making knives for about 10 years, and I've been working with a lot of chefs, a lot of Instagram guys, a lot of celebrity chefs. I've always felt that the most important thing about my knives are they're, I want them to be approachable. I try not to talk down to anyone. I try not to use big words. I try not to make knives too unapproachable. I really want to make them something that people use. Besides Jacques Pepin, you're the only other chef who I've really felt a connection with in the sense of your delivery and what you're sending out in the world in terms of everybody can cook. It's not hard. You just do a nice job, easy, simple ingredients, easy technique, and don't overthink it. And I just wanted you to know that, like, I was thinking about this since we started. I talked to you in regards to you coming on the show, and I wanted to say that what you're doing is just as good, is just as important for that as Jacques Pepin.
Well, I mean, thank you, but I have no words because can't.
It's true.
Well, thank you.
I also see the messages that people are writing about how much they love what you're doing and the fact that you're making it very approachable. And you're making it easy enough that people can say, I can do this too.
Yes. And I think, that's kind of what I set out to do. So, and I get some of the most like amazing DMs from people and comments from people. And in the same way, those are the things, you know, you keep making videos, but, it's almost like it's the perfect feedback because it's like, I'm doing what I'm setting out to do, which is like, well, I mean, what else can you really ask for? To be able to be part of that.
Well, you also had on Instagram, I kind of got off to, I tried TikTok only because with the knife making world, you know, the custom knife business has been so hard on the social media landscape. And a lot of it's because there have been all these weird, you know, regulations and stuff. And knife makers have all been restricted to a certain degree. And then a lot of people are going over to TikTok. And then I've actually personally found TikTok to be a place I just didn't like it. So yeah. I kind of stopped with TikTok. When would you start to notice your I'm going to say meteoric rise, because I remember about a year and change ago, you were just making it happen and stuff like that. And then you've kind of blown up. When do you think that started?
I don't know if I can track it back to a specific piece of content that I put out. But Instagram was unique in the way that both TikTok and Facebook seemed to grow pretty well. And not like anything crazy, but pretty steadily. And Instagram wouldn't grow for me. I make the piece of content. I pretty much put the exact piece of content on all of the platforms, including YouTube. I make it, and I make it anyway, so I just put it everywhere.
Right.
And Instagram, I kept plugging away. And, I couldn't even tell you when, but, I would gain 60 followers or 80 followers. And I'm talking over the course of like months.
Yeah.
Just keep going. And then at one point in time, I couldn't even tell you what it was. There was one piece of content I put on Instagram and it blew up to it blew up to like a few hundred thousand views on Instagram. And whatever it did, it almost unlocked something on the platform of Instagram. And then Instagram started to flood all of these pieces of content that I had already made, but I had been doing it for long enough to where I already had like a decent library of content. So I was already making, pretty decent videos at that time. I was kind of like I had grown beyond the phase where you're just starting out and everything is very awkward,
Yeah.
So once they started to show all my stuff to people, I had a gigantic library that was already there. And so that kind of led me to where I am now. But especially on Instagram, happened very quick. All of this has really kind of happened very quick, in my own estimation.
But I mean, sorry for interrupting.
No, I was going to say, it was probably about a year, maybe a little bit more than a year, is when I really started to treat it almost like a job, like a business. You start to see there's something there. And you go, I need to take this serious if I want to, be doing this.
I think it's fantastic. And I couldn't be happier for you because, you're one of the kind of people that really, in the food kind of content business, you're the kind of person that I really want out there because you're giving people things that are, it's not just like, all right, we're going to have caviar on French fried potato, fried chicken or something like that. And it's stuff that some people just can't really wrap their, can't see themselves doing it. And you make all these things so easy. So for me, it's like, this is the kind of guy that you want to see who's doing well. I'm really fascinated by the fact that you said you felt like something was unlocked. This is something that, I talk to a lot of custom knife makers and people trying to get involved with social media. And obviously it feels as though a lot of people are having problems just tracking and having people, building and stuff like that. I always felt like, I guess from what I understand, there is something to do with consistency, and you're very consistent. You post every day. And it's always something interesting and always something new. And it's always something, you're not going all over the place. You're doing the same kind of style. And it's just, you're probably right. You're probably right. It is something that you've just unlocked some algorithm. But you know what? The other thing is this has to do with people sending it. That was the one thing I noticed. I only have had one reel that went berserk. And it was a stupid reel, and it's infuriating to me only because it had nothing to do with the knives. It was, I made pizza on the grill, and I put the pizza on a Silpat mat, and then I flipped it. And people started sending it around, and that's what kind of creates that virality. As long as people start sending it, and the next thing you know, Instagram kind of does a little bit of a push, and next thing you know, it goes viral. I'm fascinated by the fact that you think that you believe that, you just worked hard enough and then they just, you unlock something.
Yeah. I remember that video that you made. Cause I remember seeing it and I was like, oh, the raw pizza dough right on the grill grates. And I've never done it myself with the raw pizza dough like that. And I just loved it. Cause it was like, I think you might be hearing in real time, other people's reaction to that video. Where, you pretty much right off the bat, you lay the raw pizza dough down right on the grill grates and people go, oh, what's happening right here? But yeah, I think it for the longest time I would do, I can't remember how many I had on TikTok and Facebook, but they both grew pretty consistently side by side. And I would put videos on, say, TikTok, and they would get, I would have a video that had like a million views or 500,000 views, and the exact same piece of content on Instagram would have 12 views.
Right.
So you go, well, so at the same time you go, well, I know people are watching it. Like, I'm making a piece of content that at least a few hundred thousand people go, oh, this seems interesting enough to at least watch for a little bit. But for some reason on Instagram, it wasn't, it's like, who knows? You put these things, sometimes you make a piece of content, you go, oh, whatever, you know, you think nothing of it. You put it up and people gravitate to it. People, you know, whatever it is, whatever that magical potion or formula is, I don't know what it is, but sometimes you just accidentally hit it.
Now, just take me back. What, did you go to culinary school?
Yes, I graduated the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park here in 2005.
Wow. How was your experience there?
I had a great experience there. It's funny the clout that it has, sort of, and like, in the area they nickname it the Harvard on the Hudson and like all these things.
That's funny.
But, you know, it's a bunch of cooks and all of your instructors are cooks, and it's like the only way to become an instructor at the CIA is to be part of the food and restaurant industry for your whole entire life, which, I mean, most people, I would say, now with books and shows and stuff, sort of get a little glimpse. You know, if you've read Anthony Bourdain books or you've watched certain accurate shows, you get a little taste of what, and it's that lifestyle. So like, but I had a great, great experience there. It's, I would say they, if you're going to put in the effort, just like anything, I would say as far as culinary schools go, they probably have the most to offer as far as, as long as you're willing to put in the work and the effort.
When did you decide you wanted to go to culinary school?
I think I was in my very early 20s, maybe 20, 21. I had gone to Dutchess Community College here. I originally wanted to be an architect. I did a lot of architecture classes in high school, and I was always really into architecture. I was always really good at like art and math. So architecture is like art and math, right, kind of put into one thing. And I went to Dutchess. I got out. I did it for a little bit. I did like drawings and stuff, and I hated it. I was in a cubicle all day long, drawing like rectangular foundations all day, every day. And it just, that's what it was. And I knew I needed something else. My father's best friend at the time, he still owns these delis. He owned a couple delis. I had no idea how to cook. He sort of needed like a number two. So he was like, hey, you know, I can trust you with the shop. I can trust you with keys. He's known me my whole entire life.
Right.
So he was like, if you want to come work for me, I'll teach you how to cook. And we went there, and I just started to fall in love with it. He also has a very like heavy, I would say, restaurant culinary background as far as scratch food cooking. So I got to work at a deli where we made everything in-house from scratch.
Wow.
And I knew I wanted to, I only had an associate's degree from Dutchess Community College. I knew I wanted to finish some sort of degree. So I was like, I think there's something here. And he really pushed me to go to culinary school. He was like, you should go to school for this. It's going to open up your whole entire life. You should definitely do this. And he pushed me out of the deli to go to school.
What a generous guy.
Yeah.
That's a very generous, thoughtful thing. Anytime you kind of have an employee that, especially someone you trust, and you push them away for their own betterment, that's a generous boss.
Yes, yes. And like I said, I mean, he was my father. He still is today, to this day, my father's best friend. He's known me most of my entire life. So, I mean, there was that sort of, you know, he has my best interest over his own store, his own deli. But he is that type of person anyway. And really, I see him, I still see him to this day. And we talk about food, or he'll look at things that I've done over my career, or places I've got to work and places I've got to go, whatever. And I'm like, it's because you pushed me to do it. And he's the same, you know, he's, oh, no, it's, you know, you did all of it. And I'm like, you know, I credit where I am today, not only just work-wise and professional-wise, but family and everything that kind of this industry has given me. He's a gigantic, gigantic part of it.
What do you remember some of the most amazing things that you were making at that deli?
I mean, it's still there. It's in the original location is in Carmel. But it's a very, very classic New York East Coast deli. So, I mean, they call if you go in there, the longer sandwiches are going to be a wedge. It's the regional wedge.
Westchester. That's a Westchester thing.
Yep. Yep. But yeah, I mean, you have like your breakfast potatoes, your bacon, egg, and cheeses. Let's see. Did I have a favorite? I mean, just we were making chicken cutlets from scratch. All the soups are from scratch. I'm trying to remember if I have a. I probably made so many bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches that you can't even wrap. You know, wrap your mind around a number.
May I just suggest that if you did, you got to do a bacon, egg, and cheese on for real. And there is no. I've had this. My business partner Tony went to the for Fader Knives. Went to the CIA too, and we have this conversation all the time about the top five sandwiches of all time.
Okay.
And bacon, egg, and cheese is one of the greatest American sandwiches of all time.
Yes,
there's no nothing better.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
If you did a classic New York style bacon, egg, and cheese, unbelievable.
Oh yeah, it's definitely on the list because there's also there are also specific things that we do here in New York. That have to be done to a bacon, egg, and cheese to make it an appropriate bacon, egg, and cheese.
Let me guess a couple of those proper yep. things. Number one is Kaiser roll. Kaiser yes. roll is on there.
Yes, has to be a hard roll.
And wrapping it in foil is an unsung clutch move.
Yes, it absolutely. That was the second piece that I was going to, is that it must be wrapped in foil, and you have to let it sit in the foil for at least say like 3 to 5 minutes. It has to sit in that foil.
I have a friend, his name is Xavier, and he is like a sommelier. He's a real food guy or wine guy. And we were talking about a bacon, egg, and cheese. And I was telling him, I said, if you don't wrap it in foil, it's no good. And he started saying, yes, that's the true sauce American, where you're creating yep. the steam from the eggs changes the Kaiser roll and then the egg yolk and then the American cheese. And it was the foil is the unsung one of the most important parts of a bacon, egg, and cheese.
Yes. And I would argue it may be even one of the most important parts of a bacon, egg, and cheese. It just becomes one. It becomes sort of like one entity when you finally unwrap it and then bite into it. It's just one thing.
All right. Now that we're getting into it, what's your opinion? And don't worry so much. There are not that many people from New Jersey. What's your opinion on pork roll versus Taylor ham?
I don't know if I have one, only because I can't say that I knowingly have had both. I have definitely had one.
It's not better than bacon, egg, and cheese.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Oh, thank you.
Good. No, all that's right. not that, even. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make that clear because I get a couple guys and, oh, I don't understand. Oh, I understand. I understand. We all understand.
Yes, yes, yes.
You don't
yes.
get the texture. The sausage roll, bacon, egg, or the whatchamacallit, the Taylor ham, pork roll, whatever you want to call it, doesn't have enough texture to make doesn't compete with a proper bacon, egg, and cheese.
Yeah, and I would say if I have one opinion on the entire subject is that it's comical to hear people from New Jersey argue about the brands of their ham for their sandwich.
Not to mention a bagel, forget it. I mean, outrageous.
Yeah. No.
A bagel on a bacon, egg, and cheese is outrageous. That's mm-hmm. outrageous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just
bagels
you
are
just
not
don't.
For egg sandwiches.
No. Nope. Right. No, you don't Great. Do it.
So you get to culinary school. You have a good time in Hyde Park. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have. So my father started his winery in the 70s, and he became very close with the people at the CIA. And we grew up going to the Culinary Institute of America all the time. He was very involved with the early programs in the 80s, and we had a real connection. And the funniest part is, I'll never forget. The funniest part is, you know, they called it the CIA. Now, my grandfather was babysitting me when I was very young, and he was at my dad's place, and my mother and my father went out for dinner, and then they came back, and my grandfather was sitting at the door waiting for my father, and he had a very stern look on his face, and my dad said, "Well, Bill, what's going on? How are you?" And he says, "Ben, we have to talk," and then he sent my mother away, and he says, "Ben, we have to talk," and my dad says, "Bill, what's wrong?" And he goes, "We just got a phone. I have a phone call for you. And I'm kind of concerned." And he goes, "What do you mean you're concerned?" He says, "They said they were from the CIA," thinking he was the Central Intelligence Industry.
Yeah.
So there was a long time where when you said the CIA, people were like shaking their heads because they're just like, "What are you talking about? What do you mean we go to school at the CIA?" And then, you know, even to this day, I've grew up you know, my father was very close with the, I don't know if you know the chef, Waldy Maloof, who was very involved with the CIA. He ended up, he was the, I think one of his last, he had a restaurant in Beacon called Beacon. And then he ended up, he was the chef at the Rainbow Room for quite a long time. And I know that I was there pre-pandemic and he was running the CIA. So we have a very strong connection with the CIA.
Okay. Yep.
And so you leave, you finish the CIA, Culinary Institute of America, and where do you think you're, where do you want to go?
At the time, I don't think I have any idea. I did my, the CIA is unique in that halfway through your education, you do a culinary externship, which you can basically go anywhere you want as long as you speak their language. So it's unique in the way that most culinary schools, you'll do an externship as part of their program at the end. So at the CIA, you do it in the middle. So you have to still return to finish your degree. So I went to the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a great time and I had a great time. It was a great experience and it taught me that I did not want to work in a hotel
for what? Why
it was like
that?
6 months. It was a good environment. It just wasn't the environment for me. I felt, I don't know, at the time if I had a specific reasoning, it didn't feel, you know, I felt out of place. In that hotel environment. I came back, finished my degree, and all along the time I was going to the CIA, one of my buddies had gone to college before, and a friend that he had was a food and beverage director that got hired by the Bohemian Club in San Francisco. So they do a, I don't know how much you know about the Bohemian Club, but there's lots of like dark kind of mysterious things around the Bohemians and the Bohemian Club.
No, I don't know anything about it.
Okay, it's a very sort of high-end, very wealthy men's club. But almost a lot of like former presidents are members. All of the Bushes are members. But then they have like people like Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead is a member, and Steve Miller from the Steve Miller Band is a member, but they have a lot of like unique members.
Right.
So they have a full-time club in San Francisco, but once a year or twice a year, they own a property in Sonoma County where they do sort of like a month-long kind of retreat out in the woods. So his friend was hired as the food and beverage director for the Bohemian Club. So they twice a year for these events, they need cooks to come out and cook. So we had gotten hooked up with him and there was probably a core group of maybe five or six guys where we went, every year we were going to the CIA, their main event lined right up with our summer break. So we would all fly out and we would work this catering event, out in Sonoma County. And you live out of a tent at a campground for like a month. And you work at this,
I'm tapping out already.
Their grounds already.
Yeah. It's happened out already. Oh my God. Working a whole shift in doing food and bev and then going straight into the tent.
Yep. They had showers. We have the quarter operated shower and everything. It was a great time. And to be, you know, for me anyway, and the core group of guys, I was probably my early 22-ish, something like that. I was my early 20s. And you just can't, you know, it's experiences that I will have forever. It's like, there's no way to have the time that we had without that, you know, without those specific events, living out of the tent and showering in these little stalls and the whole thing. And plus it's full of, there's like 40 cooks that go. So every night at the campsite is a fire and a party and it's a wild time. You leave with a ton of money cause they pay you a whole bunch of overtime and everything, but it's a great time. Wow. So while I was going to school, I had lined up a job at their full-time club. So by the time I graduated, I had a job. My wife, currently, we were dating. She went to Marist. She graduated Marist. We moved out to, we ended up living in Berkeley and both worked in San Francisco for, I guess, 5 or 6 years almost. We were there.
Wow.
So I started, that's kind of what got us to California is that I had the job lined up at the Bohemian Club. I only worked there for a short time, but over the years continued to do that, that same catering event that they do, out in Sonoma.
One of the things I don't think people realize about the restaurant industry is how transient the business can be. And when I say that, I mean that, like, you know, people aren't staying in restaurants for long periods of time. They're constantly moving around, or maybe restaurants are going out of business, or maybe you're finding something else. There has to be a type of personality that loves the restaurant business that is totally comfortable with the lack of security in terms of your job. Don't you think?
I do think. And now that, you know, I'm a little bit old, you know, I'm older now, both worlds definitely exist. But I think if you're the right type of person, that it's important to take advantage of what you're talking about, as a young cook.
Yeah.
Because like everything, no one person can teach you everything. And it's an industry about, of learning. You know, the more you can experience, the more different avenues you can learn from, the better it's going to make you, you know, in the long run. And then, you know, there's a time in your life as a cook where the restaurant, the food, that whole environment is the most important thing in your life. And then there comes a time where it's not anymore, where maybe you have a kid, maybe you get married, you have a serious relationship or whatever that is. And that's okay too. A lot of cooks at least, they get lost in that. And they feel that the restaurant and the food and your coworkers, everything have to be the most important thing in your life forever.
It's brutal because, I mean, the restaurant business now, and I don't know how you, based off the people you talk to or the areas that you're at, right now, as of now, the restaurant business is not doing well in my area. I have friends of mine, the owners of restaurants, and just business isn't that great. I get worried about cooks who are uncomfortable, you know, either getting laid off or something happened or the restaurant didn't do well this past week or all of a sudden the checks are bouncing or, you know, all of a sudden there are problems. And it's just it's an incredible business, and I had a wonderful time working in the restaurant industry. But you have to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations, and part of that is, you know, the lack of stability of the work.
Yeah, and it's a grueling environment. It's hard on your mind. It's hard on your body. It's hard to do. I think I've thought about this before, and I've talked with like some other kind of food content creators as well that come from the professional world. And it almost is like this beautiful sort of place to come from to jump into social media, because there's nothing, there's no comment, there's no direct message, there's nothing that anyone can say that I have not heard, you know, a million times more intense in real life to my face, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
It's a hard world, and you know, it is what it is. And in some places it's accepted, in many ways it's starting to kind of become a little bit better. But also at the same time, it turns you, you'll become the you know, you stay with it and you'll become that person. I lost my train of thought there, but
no, my pathway through to knife making is interesting because I went to college in Ohio and I was an art major. My father was a painter too. And my sisters are both sculptors and I wanted to be a sculptor. I went to sculpture. I did a major art major. I did mostly steel work and metal work and lots of colorful stuff. I did these, you know, giant sculptures, painted steel sculptures and stuff like that. And then I ended up getting a studio in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I worked for artists and stuff like that. But then before I got married, my father had worked he used to go one day a week and he worked at the Rainbow Room. And he was very friendly with the owners of the Rainbow Room. They'd known him forever. So when he was in his 70s into his 80s, he'd go every Thursday to the Rainbow Room and work in the pastry department. They loved him. At the Rainbow Room, they saw him as the father. And he was the oldest guy there. He'd come and make the banana bread for the restaurant for the week. And he was just part of the restaurant game and the winery and everything like that. And so before I got married, I thought maybe I should go to culinary school. And while I was in culinary school, I got a job an opportunity to do some custom furniture for a friend of mine who worked at Crate and Barrel. And they said, we have this restaurateur who wants something custom made. And I thought about you. So he reached out to me, and it turned out to be Charlie Palmer. And they had a restaurant in Grand Central Station called Metrazur. And they wanted an unstealable table, because I don't know if you've been to Grand Central lately, mm-mm, but where the Metrazur was is now where the Apple Store is. And there's this stairs that go up the side, and then there's a landing, and then there's more stairs to the restaurant. Well, they had a table that would get stolen, so they wanted an unstealable table. And I said, oh, I'll design you a 300-pound table. No one's going to walk away with this table. And then they wanted me to meet, and I said, I can't meet with you. I'm in culinary school. Charlie's guys hired me on the phone call, and they wanted me to be a project manager. So I got to cook in Oriole like three times. I worked with, you know, now one of the cooks was Brian Voltaggio and all these, you know, all these now these big time chefs. And Charlie's like, I don't need you cooking. I want you to help me build my restaurant. So I ended up being in the restaurant game, and then I ended up being the general manager for one of his restaurants. And then it was not, I'd been recently married, and it was just not the life that I wanted. Yeah. I wanted to go back to sculpture, went back to sculpture, did a little bit of help for a friend of mine who was running a bakery. He needed some help, and I helped him there. And then I ended up getting a job as a blacksmith in not too far from where I live. And we did ornamental ironwork. We did the gates of the Dakota building. And we also did teaching, and we had international teachers come, and I was turned into a blacksmith. I ended up helping make, you know, teaching knife making. I thought I could do this because I don't have to lift any, you know, anything at over 25 pounds. And then I started making knives. I was fabricator, but it all kind of came together.
And what's that's such an interesting path. Yeah.
Well, but I mean, it all came, you know, if it wasn't for all those experiences, I think that, you know, for Fader Knives, the food business helped me more than the learning how to forge or learning how to make knives. Because customer service is such a giant part of our business. Mm-hmm. And we've really made customer service such a huge part. And a lot of that's because my business partner was the chef at Oriole, and Allison who works for us, she was in the restaurant game. And even the guy who works for me, works in the shop, David, he was a chef. Everybody in my in the company has worked in the hospitality business. And the thing is, I found that the hospitality business has gained me more being conscious of how the business could be better. And it's helped Fader Knives grow without question.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like it's such an interesting path, too. That's
well, it's all the same thing. But cooking and making things and cooking, it's all. I said this to when Charlie said, I hear you want to work at Oriole, but you got an interview with the chef. And the chef at the time was a guy by the name of Jerry Hayden, who passed away a few number of years ago. And Jerry Hayden knew me because I was building stuff for him. He knew I was a welder. And he says to me, I know you're Charlie's guy, but I'm not going to be easy on you. We're going to interview. And he says, you're a welder. What makes you think you can cook? And I said to him, and it came out of nowhere, I said, well, you know, making sculpture, making welding, it's all the same. And cooking, it's all the same. You're taking ingredients and giving them proper technique, and then you end up giving it to someone. There's no difference. I said, if you're making sculpture and making food, it's the same. And he's just like, yeah, and he cursed a little bit. He cursed under his breath. Yeah, you got me. I wasn't expecting that. That was a good one. You know, you can stage tomorrow. And I worked in. So, I mean, I don't see much of a. I see it's all, you know, the same. I don't see any difference.
Yeah, and even looking back, like even like my architecture background and things like that. When you get into it, it is. It has such a, and even as a kid, I always, I'd always like take apart an old toaster and see if it worked when I put it back together, or you know, stuff like that. I've always been into doing stuff like that. And then you get into those fields, and it's like not inevitable that you'd end up where you are, but it makes sense. It puts the pieces together.
Well, it helps. I mean, it helps. All the experiences that you've had in your life are helpful. You know, I feel like the biggest problem, and we talk about this on Knife Talk, we talk about this on here, that social media has given, social media in general has given people a false sense of competency. And it's also a false sense of confidence. And one of the reasons, one of the things that people don't understand is things aren't instantaneous. and that experience is underrated. I feel as though I look back to the first job I ever had. I got a job cleaning up the tree pits on 62nd Street between Lexington and Fifth. And I would every once a week, I was 15 or something like that, 14, 15. And I'd have a bag and I'd have gloves on and I would pick out the cigarette butts and the dog poo and then the garbage that people would throw in the tree pits, you know, on the street. So it was like 60 some odd tree pits. And every week I'd go and I'd with a bag and the gloves and I'd pick everything up and throw it away. And what it taught me was I didn't have, and then I'd send them a bill. My mother helped me send a bill once a month. I'd send a bill. And there was nobody telling me. There was no boss. There was just like the board of the block association would send us a bill. I would send a bill to the block association. Block association send me a check. I learned how to work independently at 14, knowing that no one's going to tell me, "All right, Jeff, you got to go to work," or mm-hmm. "Jeff, you got to go do your thing," or "Now where are you? They had no idea. So I had to, you know, figure out how to schedule my own time and be, you know, efficient and to be diligent and be organized. And I learned that from then on. I mean, that was a huge, I hate it. I always say it was number one is the best paid I ever was, the best paying job I ever was. And I ended up doing such a good job. I got $75 a week and I got it down to doing it in 45 minutes. And then I got a job cleaning the tree pits or the islands on Park Avenue from 54th Street to 79th Street. And I got to do that once a week for $100. And I got that down to an hour because people don't really throw that much garbage on those things. Mm-hmm. So I got to the point where for 2 hours worth of work, I was making $175.
Yep.
So I say that it was the worst job I ever had, but the best paying job I ever had. And, but all those, you know, that helped me figure out how to be organized and independent.
Yeah, you get so much out of stuff like that. It teaches you can make money, you can figure things out. You get a lot of lessons from stuff like that.
I had too much money. I was making, for a kid my age, it was too much money. It was too much money I didn't even know what to do with it.
Yeah.
To the point where I was buying comic books and then I was buying, you know, what this and the dumb stuff. And then I ended up saving enough money to go to Europe. But that was about, I mean, that was the only, I was like, oh, what the hell am I going to do with all this money? How many comic books can I buy? Mm. And, you know, and it was hilarious. But I guess I wonder, how did you become, I mean, I only know you from, you know, we've talked before and I love Every Day is Feast Day is such a great watch. How did you figure out how to become so just diligent? Because your reels are very diligent. You don't really sway from it's a very, very consistent, enjoyable pattern.
Well, thanks. I mean, I really enjoy the creative aspect of it. So like my brain will tend to work like that, where I get things that just sort of, whether they're ingredients or ideas or that will just sort of inspire and sort of my own self, you know, and just kind of spiderweb into an idea for something. And I think it's both the work ethic that I'm used to working a lot, as a professional chef and even, you know, a young cook and things like that. You know, it's not uncommon. You're working 100 hours a week, 100 plus hours a week, and it's always hard work. So this is unique in that it's allowed me sort of an artistic expression, which is somewhat addictive in that way. But you also start to see the potential, you know, just not even to lie about anything or, you know, be soft about anything, but you see the potential for income and you see the potential for like where it could go. And that's also a big driver, especially in an industry like the food industry, because even today, you know, I'm still operating as a full-time executive chef at my current job, while I make all these videos. And it's like, well, what am I going to do? Like, can I retire, can I whatever, and you start to like, you know, you start to piece together these pieces of content, and not only are you leaving like kind of this library of content, but it just it creates a new avenue using the 20 plus whatever years that I've done this professionally. It creates a whole new avenue to open up all kinds of things that I don't even know that exist yet.
Tell me about the restaurant you work at now. I didn't realize that you're also still a professional chef. you don't have to, it's up to you how much ever you want to give, but I mean, what kind of work are you doing now?
Oh, yeah. People ask, can I come eat at your restaurant? But I'm currently the executive chef at a monastery here in up near me.
Wow.
It's an Episcopalian monastery and retreat center. So people come and stay on retreat. So we're kind of open to the public, but not exactly like a restaurant would be open to the public. We get a lot of, we get a lot of spiritual retreats, but we also have like knitting groups that come. We have gardening groups that come. So we get non-spiritual retreats also, but I run the food program there. We feed them breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Wow. Yeah. 7 days a week?
We're open 6 days a week. We close, today is the day where there's no food service, no nothing that happens there. So they have about 20 live-in monks, and then groups come and stay on retreat there.
What do you serve these monks? I'm fascinated. I love the whole idea that do they have a special diet?
No, I mean, you have your normal food industry, especially now, you have your normal gluten-free and dairy-free and different types of allergies and sensitivities. But they're really good, and I basically get to make whatever I want. I've been there, this past year was 10 years, so I have, you build a relationship. They know that I'm going to make, good food, and they won't have to worry about, the basics of it. And they really are open to eating a lot of things. I mean, we make food from all different types of cultures and countries. And, if a cook has like an idea for something, let's work on that. Let's work with that one. Oh, I want to make German food, or, oh, I want to make Ethiopian food. And you go, okay, we'll figure it out, and we'll figure out what to make. So that also provides a really nice environment as far as like exploring new things and coming up with kind of new ideas.
That sounds like a lot of fun because, I mean, it seems as though, I mean, do you have like a, do you get to meet these monks and talk to them about what they like? And do some of them say, I really wish you made this? Or do you ever have any requests?
Oh, yeah. We get requests. And by now they're, they're such a fixture over there. We're on pretty much with all of them. I'm on kind of a first name basis. I've been there long enough and they're up and around. It's not, most people kind of have the image of a a Buddhist monastery where there's lots where they keep to themselves and many of the retreats are in silence, but these monks are they're just like regular a house full of 20 guys that have agreed to live their life in the way that they live their life. But as far as like being telling jokes and they're just normal everyday people. If you met one of them out at the grocery store or something, you would never guess that they're a monk or they live like a monastic lifestyle.
Do they watch your content? Do the monks come up to you and say, I really like that spatchcocking the chicken video?
Yeah, a few of them do, and I get a lot of guests. Especially a lot of the guests that come are seniors a lot of them are heavy Facebook users. So I'll get, they'll come on retreat and they'll go, oh, I love watching your stuff. I love, they'll comment on stuff and leave stuff, or I'll make dishes at the monastery that I'll do a video about. And then they'll comment on the video and say, oh, this was so delicious, or, whatever the case is. But it's fun to have like kind of a following that comes to the retreat center.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So when you come up with the reels that you're going to do, the food content you're going to do, how in advance are you thinking about it? Because you do stuff every day.
Yes, sometimes it can be that day. I mean, many times it'll be that day. I might have, we have a few different things. My wife and I will almost meet once a week as like a business meeting. And I have a little space in my house set up as a home office, and we have dry erase boards and we write things down. And so this way it's in, it's in a common traffic area in my house, at least the dry erase board is. So that we're passing by it, we're walking by it, we're constantly ping-ponging ideas off of each other. So it'll come from things like that. If a food topic is trending currently, recently there was like a Listeria outbreak. So like I did Listeria as the word of the day to kind of help, to give people a place to go if they were confused about what it is, how do I get it, how do I keep myself safe from it, where it's coming from, things like that. Plus usually when topics like that, like Listeria, is in the news, it's also trending on social media. So usually when you do stuff like that, you can get decent attention on it.
What do you think about what's going on with the bird flu and the and how eggs are being treated these days? Because it isn't – I mean, the price of eggs are high, and a lot of it is because of this – you know, the bird flu. My wife is a – she's got a double master's. One is in epidemiology, so she's heavily in, you know, looking at bird flu in general. How do you feel this egg thing is going to change cooking? For the short period, you think that's going to have an issue, or
I don't know entirely. And one thing that I did realize very recently, because my wife does probably pretty much, I'll say 100%. My wife does 100% of our grocery shopping. But obviously I buy all the food at the monastery for our professional kitchen.
Yeah.
And I'm still getting, I get local organic free running, you know, all the buzzword eggs.
Yeah.
For four-ish dollars a dozen. I mean, granted, I'm buying a 15 dozen case.
Yeah.
But then when you walk into a grocery store, you see $10 a dozen. Yeah. Well, I've seen, you know, you get super
really?
High. Yeah. I bought a dozen eggs. We needed them not that long ago. I think it was $10 for the, it was like, you know, only it was like free range or it was whatever they had, the best ones had that I could get. They were almost $10 for the dozen. So it's like, to me, it's almost as if like, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there's something else here. I don't know the numbers on all the bird flu stuff. But I mean, I'm definitely speaking out of turn as far as, you know, your wife is going to know a lot more about like the actual cases of the bird flu. But to me, it almost feels a little bit distractional, like in other, I think the last one that people I'd get asked from friends and stuff were the ports when they were going to say that ports were going to close, the ports were going to close. And I don't know, but it's like there's so like when you think about what goes on in the ports, who runs the ports, how much money comes in and out of the ports, you start to think like, you know, I in my opinion, I don't think the ports are going anywhere.
Well, it's just that the eggs, if they're like the bird flu is affecting the eggs because they're getting rid of all these egg laying chickens. So it's like a, you know, that's the issue. But I find it fascinating because it does give you the opportunity to do like, basically like, you know, during the pandemic, at one point Jacques Pepin was doing these recipes. Some of them are like, he was teaching you how to make tuna casserole with canned tuna and canned beans and rice. He was, and then like mushroom soup, you know, condensed mushroom soup. And then he was doing one at one point, and a lot of it was because the people were at home and they didn't have a lot of money or something was going on.
Yeah,
he did one reel about how to make spam steaks, you know. And it was very like, it was, I mean, some people would be like, I would never eat something like that, but there was something about the fact that he was not taking advantage, but he was making something within the confines of the time where, you know, there are issues at foot, and maybe you don't have a lot of money, and, you know, maybe this is, you know, how do you make something, you know, basically catering his content to the time that we're living in now.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you know, it's no secret that food has gotten the cost of food has gotten wildly out of control. And so many ingredients are so high that, like, you know, people will just shut them out of their diets, for no other reason than they have to spend their money elsewhere, you know, different types of meats or red meats or beef or things like that climb in price. And I think that provides another whole new avenue of cost-effective dishes, cost-effective ingredients. Almost, you know, it's almost very 50s feeling, you know, when you get this boom of canned foods, frozen things, you know, in combination with you know, obviously all of the knowledge that Jacques Pepin has, and people gravitate towards how is this guy using canned beans and canned corn? And because the average home cook is opening a can of corn, they go, okay, you know, they heat it up, they go, here's the corn, but he's going to turn it into some sort of casserole or some sort of dip or some sort of thing, you know, while still maintaining in your budgets. And I think, especially to people that get so overwhelmed with the cost of foods and the cost of everything, which is, it hits everybody. You know, they start to realize that they can also create these things. I think it's exciting for people. It turns kind of a dreary, overwhelming topic into something like fun and exciting again.
Do you think, What are some of the things that you're most interested in kind of heading down the line of culinary content? Is there anything new and exciting that you're really kind of interested in tackling?
I don't know that if I can think of anything off the top of my head.
Do you know what blows people's minds when you cook vegetables on a sheet tray and then you have a wire rack and stuff on top of it?
Oh yeah,
that might be the most mind-blowing thing that you do for other people. No one's ever thought about that. And I see the responses. People lose their mind.
Yeah, it is. Those are popular ones. Those are good ones. Yeah, and the potential for that, you know, I use it as like a cooking method. So both the potential for it is unlimited, and also it lends itself to almost unlimited content. You know, I could make, there's enough recipes where you could make a video every day about things to put on a rack over top of other things. But yeah, and when you say it, it's such a simple thing. I think that's another piece of why people gravitate to it so heavily.
There was one Jacques Pepin video he did that blew people's minds. He basically took rice and, you know, chicken stock and vegetables and all this stuff and put it in like a casserole dish, covered the top with foil, and then seasoned some chicken legs and put the chicken legs on top of the foil. So the rice would steam and then the chicken would roast on top of the foil. And it was like this double stack method, and it was blowing people's minds. They had no idea that you could do that.
Yeah, it's just a lot of those things. It's so interesting. I mean, I had my mind blown recently from seeing raw pizza dough onto a grill. But it's those things that people don't think about. One is coming to mind where I do, and I've done it, I've made it forever, but a chicken Caesar salad where I roast the chicken on top of the bread. And then, so the raw chicken obviously roasts on top of the bread.
Yeah.
All of the brown stuff and everything that usually sticks to the bottom of the tray is now all inside of your bread, and it toasts the bread while it roasts the chicken. And then you make a Caesar salad and you chop up the bread, and those chickeny bread, like that chickeny bread becomes the crispy croutons in the salad. And that's another thing that people see and they go, like, you know, you see it, you know, you almost see it in real time. This, where your mouth starts to open, they go like, oh, is he going to use the bread as the croutons? And then by the time you get to the end, they go, oh, he used the bread as the croutons. But it's just one of those things that, like, when you, it's like a little peek into someone's mindset, almost like a creativity mindset.
What are you most surprised about that people ask you about or say to you? What surprises you that your viewers tell you? Anything?
Yeah, I think if I had to, the thing probably that one of the things that like brings me the most joy when I hear about, is I'll get comments or even direct messages from people that are making these recipes. Or some people will have I was making the recipe, but I didn't have this XYZ ingredient, but I used this other ingredient. And to me, that's like, you know, I want to yell like, way to go. It's like the whole point, one of the points why I'm doing the videos in the style that I am is to get people like, you know, delicious food should not be intimidating. It should not be this crazy thing. And it's meant to play, you should be playing with your food and trying new things. And, oh, I didn't have red wine vinegar, but maybe I have cider vinegar. I have this other thing. Let me try it out. What is it? You know, I think people have this phobia or maybe fear of, oh, I didn't have the right kind of ingredient. It's going to be inedible. And it's just not the case. You know, you can make these things. And at the same time you go, oh, you make a recipe or you make this type of food. You go, oh, I really can do this.
That's one of the best, a few of the best things that you do. One is you're very, very like active responding back to the people who write things in your videos. The other thing is you also make things very approachable in the sense of, oh, if you don't have this, you can use that. If you don't want to use whatever you want, it doesn't really matter. And I think that makes things a little bit more approachable is the right word. One of the things people ask me about, what's the best cookbook you've ever written or ever read. And one cookbook I love to suggest because it's Tom Colicchio's book, Think Like a Chef. And one of the reasons why is because he's not necessarily giving you recipes. he's showing you techniques, and then you can substitute things out. You know, it doesn't have to be a recipe, you know, down the line. How much is this? Well, how much is that? How much is this? And what's the exact temperature? Or what's the, you know, some people, and like sometimes they ask you these like very, very exact questions that I know that come from a place of people follow recipes and they're used to following recipes and they really don't want to understand that it's about, you know, technique, and then you can kind of substitute out. That's one of the things that you do that's so great, is you're giving people a wide berth to kind of you're giving them a starting point that they can kind of venture out with the recipes.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and I really like set out to do stuff like that, and I think it's you know, it is almost like that, like it's how a lot of our grandmothers, but my grandmother specifically, you know, it's that old cliche, you know, a pinch of this, a pinch of that, or, you know, oh, my grandmother never measured anything. She would just feel things and taste things. And that, and, you know, both my grandmother and my mother, as far as like, are probably two of the best cooks I have ever known, you know, and yeah. I've worked in Michelin star restaurants. And, you know, I'm using that term as far as like, obviously there are insane cooks that I have worked with on a professional level. But as far as just, you know, just making food. I mean, it's really, that's really one of the main things that I really try to want to get across to people, at least that want to receive the information, that you can cook exactly like that. And it's not intimidating. Everyone, I mean, not everyone, but you know, if you can read, you can cook, because the way the internet is, you have resources to any kind, Indian food and food from Somalia and any kind of food you want. There's a recipe that exists for everything, and you can read the recipe. It's just a matter of getting the ingredients, reading the instructions, and making the recipe. So, but I think, especially, you know, Indian food is a good example, because there's always like a ton of spices and things, but people are intimidated by it. Maybe they had it in a restaurant and they, you know, oh, it tastes so exotic and so different. I think that it carries a level of intimidation to it. And you know, all it takes is just to sort of break through that fear or intimidation that you might have, and you can really do anything that you want.
I feel as though, for when I look back, you know, I'm 51, so I feel as though like I remember the days of, you know, Channel 13 was Julia Roberts and Julia Childs, yep. And Julia Roberts, yeah. Julia Childs and Jacques Pepin and The Frugal Gourmet, and you know, like that. And then I feel as though the Food Network kind of started in the early 80s. Next thing you know, when Emeril kind of came on board, he kind of ushered in the Food Network to the point where people started to be engaged in food, because it was almost like something, you know, incredible restaurant style food, like delicious food, that became like this open, you know, feeding the interest of the American viewer. Nowadays with social media, I feel as though food content has made people far more adventurous and far more interested, especially in local stuff. Like I follow a lot of like influencers who are in New York, and I do a lot of guys in Philly, because we're involved with a lot of people in Philly. And what I love the fact is that there's so much great content, but it's localized food content, which I hope is helping these smaller businesses, as opposed to the Food Network. Just, you know, you had Bobby Flay, or you had Emeril, or you had somebody teaching you how to cook, but you had very specific people from specific areas, not only teaching you how to cook, but where to go to eat it.
Yeah. And I think, like to me, when the Food Network has really fallen off now, where, you know, they'll give a cooking show to any sort of like old actor from the 1980s or 1990s or whatever, where to me, when they were at their prime, they were, even the early days of Michael Simon and Emeril Lagasse and Bobby Flay and Mario Batali, you know, whatever people think of him today. But, you know, they were giving shows to, it almost gave, similar to social media today, but it gave a platform for, you know, real chefs that have put in the time and spent their life doing that craft, to sort of work their way out of that kitchen lifestyle and get into something, you know, obviously much more lucrative and much more beneficial to their overall, you know, life. But at any moment in time, those guys could, even still today, could walk into any restaurant on the face of the earth and work a line, you know, expedite a line, any position in any kitchen. And the Food Network doesn't have shows like that anymore.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't watch the food. We don't watch the Food Network.
I shouldn't. I haven't seen it either in a very long time. So I'm speaking out of line.
I got Food Network. When you're a knife maker, you end up becoming friendly with all these guys. So I'm friendly with a lot of these. It's an exaggeration, but I'm acquaintances with some of these Food Network guys. And I don't know if people are watching the Food Network like they're watching content on YouTube, on Instagram and Facebook. I mean, and just social media in general. I mean, now you get to see how the views are in real time, and then all of a sudden you're just realizing, like, there's that Instagram chef. Her name is Olivia. I don't know her last name, but she's she's great because she is, you know, matter of fact. And I think a lot of it is the fact that she gives the finger and she does all this stuff.
Yeah, people like that. Yeah.
Created an incredible following. She was just on Jimmy Fallon last week. It's crazy because you have the ability to kind of create your own content, and then you can see your ratings almost. You know, you see with the views, you see the numbers, and you see the growth. And I think it's fantastic. I think it can be, I think it probably can be very difficult on some people. I mean, I notice, you know, comments that some people get, and I notice comments that you get sometimes, and you're very smart to just avoid them altogether because some of them are just like unreasonable. But that's the cost of doing business in the modern day on the internet, I guess.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it really is. And I for stuff like that, I think it's really just a game of percentages where you go, like, you know, how many people in real life, say out of like 100, are just like a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, 100%. It's probably more than one. So then you're dealing with like 1%. You know, 1% of 100 is one person. Then I have like 200 something thousand followers on TikTok. So it's like that 1% is now what is it, 2,000 people?
Yeah.
So it's when you work with those numbers, it's just inevitable that you're going to get. Plus, not everybody, but you definitely have people that, like, you know, they like, here's what I, you know, they want to give your opinion. Here's what I think about this. Oh, I, you know, almost as if they can't wait to say, you know, things that people would never say to each other in real life, in person.
There's a couple ones that I remember from your post. One of them was you did some cooking technique and he says, no, chef, that's not how you do it. And then he almost gave his own recipe in the comments and how you're supposed to do it, which I always find that to be hilarious. But my favorite one was you use a lot of spices, and you were using spices, and a guy wrote, that's just perfect Americans using, what did he say? He said powders, chemical powders. That's not cooking. All you Americans, that's all you use is powders in your cooking. And I was just like, bro, it's spices. What are you talking about? But it was funny to me because it was just like, you had no choice. He had to say something, and he was like, look at this guy putting all these powders in the food. That's not cooking. Hilarious.
Yeah, I used a lot of them. When I first started, there was much less comments, but I used to say, like, you know, I would be like, make sure to tag me when you make a video about it so I can see where I went wrong.
Because these people make nothing.
You know, these people aren't creating anything, which, again, people don't necessarily need to do any of that. But, you know, and especially you're going to you involve, you know, different, you know, you have like, oh, I'm from this country and you're from this country and a typical blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know, at a certain point in time, it's like, okay, you know, okay. Well, I mean, what do you want
It's never worth it. It's never worth it. I find I've been doing social media for like 13 years. I've been from the beginning of Instagram, and it was a way for me to get out of I was a sculptor, and it got me out of the galleries because I felt like I hated the relationships I was having with these gallerists. And social media allowed me to be my own PR department and sell stuff and stuff like that. And what was interesting was I've never really got a lot of like trolls, I guess you call them, or people who say awful things, and probably because I'm a knife maker, and generally you don't only some knife makers get a lot of real problems. I don't really get a lot of problems. I don't ask for problems either. But what I won't do is I don't want to engage, and the reason why is it's too much emotional energy for me to engage and then think about what they're going to say, and I'm waiting for them to respond, and then I have to respond, and then how much is it going to be? It's too much energy. So I've always been of the mind of, like, if somebody says something awful, I just leave it alone. And then it's like, it's almost like more disrespectful because you're not even going to give them the time of day. And that's always the better on my fragile ego. My ego's too fragile. I can't be fighting people on the internet. Can't do it.
Well, and it is, and there's really something to be said about that mental energy, because you've already...
It's mental energy.
Yeah, it really is, and it's, I mean, it's powerful as it is, but you really, you know, in the nicest way possible, you know, you owe these people nothing. You've already created, like, I love the videos where you flip the different materials, and then, like, you either have a knife or a fork or whatever. They're entertaining to watch, and they are always like, I'm like, oh, what's this one going to be? Like, I see you have the hand, or you might have a wrench and a pink thing or whatever, and then you flip it and have some, like, a paring knife or a shop knife or whatever. But I see it, and I know what's coming, but I don't know the end result, so I always wait for the end result. And it's like, you've created this piece of entertaining content. You don't owe me anything. It's entertaining me. You know what I mean? You owe me nothing other than you're already giving me this piece of thing for free. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I appreciate you saying it. Do you know where that all came from?
No.
We had the knife community, the knife making community had a lot of problems, and we were getting restricted. Our content was getting restricted to the point where, you know, there was a time when reels, Instagram was pushing reels, and they were giving you these artificial pushes to do the reels. Well, all of a sudden, knife makers fell under the category of being, restricted or prohibited materials. For whatever reason, mm-hmm, it could be from what's going on in the UK.
Yeah, weapons or whatever. Reason. Yeah,
whatever. Yeah, but it got to the point where we all saw real, like, no growth at all. To the point where, uh-huh, if I look at my account status, it'll say they can't recommend me. And that's because, so a lot of it was in the beginning was to not use really the algorithms that Instagram was providing, but to try to figure out ways in which to get people to kind of, it's not a knife yet. So, like, it was trying to figure out ways in which to do these almost like hocus pocus magic tricks to get, and what it did was it got me away from these weird algorithms that Instagram was doing. So it was completely 100% a response to the way we were being the way we were being viewed or restricted, or people were calling it a shadow ban or whatever it was. But I was trying to figure out ways in which to work around the algorithms, basically, and it worked. And then people got sick of it, and then I'd do it every so often.
Okay, yeah, you like just out of trying different things, you end up like...
No, it's just so old hat. It's old hat. I do it every so often because it's fun, and it's I've gotten it down to the point where it's relatively easy, but, like, you know, I mean, I don't need to really... I'm trying to, like, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm trying to do, frankly, but at the same time, I can't be doing, you know, dancing around all the time. I'm getting too old.
People might want to see you dance.
I don't know. It ain't happening, Bob. Bob, it ain't happening. It ain't happening. Bob, what is next for you? And every day is feast day.
Well, I had this year we're making sort of adding YouTube to the mix.
Oh, so cool.
YouTube. I was dabbling with the shorts for a little while, but recently YouTube lengthened the time that shorts can be. So I know they used to only be able to have 60 seconds. But now you can have, I think it's up to 3 minutes or something. So now I don't have to, like, re-edit any of my content or anything like that. Most of my videos are less than 3 minutes anyway. So I can now flood them all onto YouTube. And then even before the TikTok ban, the plan was to at least, I guess I should say do, but just start making, I want to experiment with making more, a little bit longer form content, like in that landscape mode of YouTube.
All right.
So for me, that's where my head is at for this year, for 2025. Those are my 2025 plans.
And have you been approached by anybody to do anything? I mean, you're so good on there, and you're so friendly and inviting, and you're so well spoken. Have there been any opportunities presenting themselves?
Well, thanks. No, I there has not been other, companies will reach out here or there. Can we send you, can we send you some of our product? Can you try this out? Can you try that out? And those have all been really cool. You get to meet like some small, some small vendors and small producers of different types of stuff. But, I haven't been contacted by anybody as far as like, whether it be creators that want to work on something together or companies that want to try to work on something together. So no, I haven't been contacted by anybody, me, myself.
And you need another knife. I need to get you another knife. So think about what you need. Well,
you're all too generous.
Well, think about, you're doing a great job.
Well, I appreciate it.
This is like we do a lot of collaborations, and a lot of the best ones are always when they're organic. And I feel as though you got a good thing going. I love what you're doing. I think we're in the kind of in the same ballpark. Let's keep the ball rolling. If you need a offset serrated, you need a paring knife, whatever you need. I feel like you're pretty good with that one knife. But if you ever need another one, you know where to go.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a fantastic knife, and even the, I would say you've touched a few times on your customer service. And the attention that went into it, not only shows obviously in its use, but when we talked last time, you talked about how you watched some of my older videos and like what knife I was currently using so that you could build something that was like, reasonably within kind of that would be comfortable for me to pick up from this knife that I was using before and things like that. And just stuff like that, you don't see. I haven't known any other custom knife makers, but obviously I'm no stranger to custom knives and things like that. And a lot of times, like you said, you want your stuff to be approachable and stuff. A lot of times you get the like, this is what I make and this is what you're going to get.
Well, I'll tell you without going too far into it, there's a couple reasons why that is. And a lot of it is because a lot of these knife makers, and I love to beat the brakes off knife makers, because one of the things is a lot of them have learned how to make knives from watching YouTube videos. Nothing wrong with that. Or they'll take a couple classes, or they'll take maybe a class or two, and then they learn how to do that. They have no experience in a metal shop. They've never worked in fabrication before. I've worked in a fabricating shop where you make something for someone and don't get too crazy. Give the people what Charlie Palmer used to say, give the people what they want. So when I was making your knife, I watched your videos. The knife I made for you was different than our standard K-tip, because I noticed that your heel was a little on the shorter side. You liked a longer blade. So I was just like, I really wanted to make sure you had something similar to what you already use, and that was going to make you want to use it more. Actually, when I made the knife for Jacques Pepin, I noticed that as he was cooking, a couple things when he was cooking. One is the fact that he uses short-heeled knives in general, because his cutting board is almost like his whole work table. And when he's cutting, a lot of times his knuckles are off the board, so his knuckles never cut it. His knuckles never touch the board.
Okay.
That's why you'll see him using long paring knives, petty knives, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. When I made his knife, I also noticed, guy's getting older, just turned 90, don't make him a heavy knife. I made the knife lighter than I normally would, just because I felt like, don't give this guy a barbell. Give the guy... He worked hard enough. Give him something. Give him something he might want to pick up. And the smart part was that's the knife that he picks up. We never had an agreement. We never told. He happened to. He picks my knives up. My knife out of his block, which I love. But that's part of the thing is giving. You got to give people what they want. And sometimes it's figuring out what they want and then watching what they do, and then you give the people what they want, Bob.
Yeah, well, I mean, it shows. You're 100% correct. It just shows. I 100%. This is one area where I can accept and feel that I have a similar experience to Jacques Pepin is when I pick up my knife.
Well, I hadn't talked to him about it. Listen, you're getting older. I'm gonna make you a lighter knife. I never talked to him.
No. But he reaches for it. He picks it up.
Yeah,
that's what he goes to. The guy's no stranger with a knife in his hands.
I got lucky, and it was like the highlight of my life. However, working with you has been just a joy, and I love it when I love seeing you use my knife. You do such a great job, and every day is feast day is a fantastic follow, and you'll pick something up. Bob's a great guy. Go to everything on Instagram. Every day is feast day. Also join his newsletter. He's got a great newsletter. I get it every Friday or once a month or something like that. It's a great newsletter. He doesn't kill you with stuff. It's a great newsletter. Bob Morano is the man. Every day feast day is where it's at. Bob, thank you so much for coming on, and we're going to have you back on again.
Absolutely. I loved it. Thanks for having me. I had a ton of fun. I had a lot of fun.
All right. Awesome. Guys, thank you so much, and we'll see you next week. Thanks again, Bob.
See ya. Thank you.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.